Thank you, Tony. I'd like to invite my namesake up to the stage, Dr. Max Konatsky. Yeah, when I invited Max to come and speak to the Aviation Club last year, he very kindly agreed to come. I thought we'd be talking about the Max, so I thought there'd be but at that point, it was about the fact he placed a massive order. Obviously, there's a few other things to talk about, and I'm sure we'll get on to that. But before I start asking the questions to Max, just a quick introduction, and we'll hear more about the detail from Max in a moment. Sun Express was formed in 1989 as a joint venture between Turkish Airlines and Lufthansa. It operates a network today of 200 routes, which have gone up since I asked you this question, 68 destinations in 35 countries, and carried 12 million passengers in 2023. And that number's going up every year. We'll hear more in a moment. It has a fleet of 71 aircraft, all 737s, of which 12 are 737 MAX 8s, and has 80 more on order and an additional aircraft on option. They're going to have 77 aeroplanes by the summer of 2024, including some short-term wet leases, and the airline is targeting to have a fleet of 150 aircraft a decade from now in 2033, and that number is going to keep rising. And to facilitate that growth, at last year's Dubai Air Show, Sun Express signed for 90 more MAX aircraft, including the ones I've just announced, 45 firm, it's 5 reconfirmable and 40 options, if I was listening carefully right. So, let's start at the beginning. You were made CEO in January 2020, moving over from Lufthansa Group, one of the parent company airlines, where you were SVP for network and partnership management for hub airlines and fleet, intending to allocate aircraft rather than planning the fleet. Given what happened just after you started, was that a bit of a baptism of fire, those first few months?
He did warn me about the mute button. First of all, thank you very much for the nice introduction. You know, a couple of years ago, it was the Max crisis, and now Max, please come to the stage. So Max, talking to Max about the Max is much better, appreciated. Unfortunately, I don't play cricket, so I can't help the team, but I'll look around. That's what I heard. Yes, it was absolutely a rocky start. Actually, there was a newspaper article when I first started. I was just telling the folks at the table, which had the 4 most pitied CEOs. I was one of them because we literally started right at the beginning of the pandemic. And, I flew down to Istanbul to meet the chairman of my board, back then İlker Ayçi, president of Turkish Airlines. And I had a reprioritized project list with me. And I said, out of these 50 projects, maybe we only do 30. He said, well, Max, there's a travel ban as of tomorrow. You might want to head back to Germany because this is probably the last flight tonight. And little did I know, for the next 6-7 weeks, I was stuck at home, then made it into Turkey on a military aircraft to finally connect with the team and start the role. Also, obviously, we had 2 airlines at the beginning. For those of you familiar with Sun Express, we had a German one and a Turkish one. And the German one with 20 aircraft and 1,500 employees, unfortunately, we had to close in light of this. So yes, it was a rocky start at the beginning.
And that German division, it wasn't planned to shut, but it's gone now. It's not coming back. So you're going to cover off that with the main airline now, are you?
It was actually more than a division. It was a separate AOC, which was important in terms of traffic rights because we were doing a lot of flights, Greece to Germany, Egypt to Germany, Spain to Germany, and this is stuff that we haven't only backfilled with the Turkish AOC we now have, which obviously, given the traffic rights, has to touch Turkey at some point. But we've backfilled that through partnerships, for example, with Air Cairo, and it sort of caters to the win-win that we bring to the table. So we're doing the commercial steering. Our point of sale is primarily in Europe. The majority of our revenue is in Euro, so we do all the commercial steering and handling. Air Cairo flies the Egyptian to Germany, Austria, Switzerland, and so on traffic. And that model's worked quite well. It's actually worked so well that we're now having over 80 weekly frequencies with Air Cairo in a Western Europe. And we've now copy-pasted that model into Bulgaria. And for those of you who've been at the Berlin ITP conference, we just announced the Bulgaria-Electra partnership where we're doing a similar model. So You don't have to have high asset intensity to actually capture market share and go into it. Sometimes the brain power of commercial steering is sufficient.
So how is that return to growth progressing? I know you actually did a pretty good job during COVID as a business. So can you talk us through that and then how you see the future and what trajectory you're on as a growth airline?
Yeah. So, I mean, after this rocky start, the turnaround was incredibly fast. So for, you know, the aviation folks here that like numbers like I do, we were at 101% ASK in 2021 already. So compared to pre-pandemic levels, 122% in 2022 and 146% last year. So that turnaround was actually done very, very quickly. You know, I think I often get asked, why was that the case? And I think there's probably three reasons. We have three different customer segments. I hope I'm not stealing your thunder on follow-up questions. If I do, just interrupt me or press the mute button on my microphone. So we have three customer segments. We have the visiting friends and relatives, we have the tourism segment, and we have the domestic Turkey travel. And typically those are 45 touristic, 45 visiting friends and relatives, 10% domestic. Obviously during the pandemic, the touristic part went down 5%, but the visiting friends and relatives, and I know there's some Turks among us here, you know, when your mother has a birthday or your sister's getting married, you better be there or you're square. So that segment picked up tremendously, and we were really thriving on that, and that made us get through the crisis. Another thing was that we had to shed cost, obviously. And so I'll just give you one example, and having sort of been educated in Europe and the US, this was mind-blowing to me at the beginning. We had to reduce salaries. And the way we did this with our operational crew was that we went from a 91% fixed salary to a 91% fixed, 9% variable to a 50-50 model. We needed to get individual signatures by every single of our 3,800 employees back then. And within 5 weeks, we had all signatures without a single objection, okay? So we were actually sort of the solidarity, and this is the SunExpress family spirit, which, having been around the world, I've never seen in any other company, was really amazing. And there's a third factor, sorry, Max, but there's a third factor. At the beginning, the Turkish government rolled out mandatory PCR tests for all of our flights within the last 72 hours. This was when, in Germany, we were thinking about, hey, should we set up an antigen testing site at the gate, right? So I thought, oh my God, like, we're demand is gonna drop significantly. But it was actually a blessing in disguise because passengers picked up because they felt safe. We had very low infection rates on board because people were PCR tested 3 days prior. And so that was actually, people felt safe flying to Turkey. And that turnaround, so the government acted very, very quickly and helped us make, you know, Turkey a safe tourist destination.
So going forward, we talked about the numbers. I think the percentage growth is double digit, right? Going forward, and fleet, given the fleet, if it arrives, when it's supposed to. We'll talk about that in a moment. But what's driving that growth ambition from a demand perspective?
Well, I think there's multiple things. I mean, traditionally we're a sun and beach carrier. We have, you know, a strong market share along the Mediterranean coast. We call it the Riviera. So that's Izmir, Bodrum, Dalaman, and Antalya. And that's still, you know, our bedrock and still what we do a lot. But we've diversified our product portfolio. We have a loyal customer sitting right next to me, and that's golfing tourism, for example. That's soccer training camps in the wintertime. That's tennis training camps. So the whole sport travel. We're doing culinary travel. We're doing historic and religious travel, actually. I mean, you can do, you know, excavations like Patara or Ephesus and, you know, historic travel. So we're expanding on the diversity of the product. We've also seen that a lot of growth comes from expanding and extending the summer season. So last year, for example, we have traditionally, we have quite a drop after October. We've now added 2,000 additional flights just from October to December last year. That's 380,000 seats. So the summer season is lasting longer. And I think last but not least, we're obviously expanding geographically. So you said 35 countries, 68 destinations. We're now flying to places like Madrid, like Barcelona, like Kuwait, Dubai, Abu Dhabi. So we're becoming more of a, you know, sort of exploiting the range of the aircraft that we have.
Now, you're mainly an NG operator at the moment, but you've got the MAX coming in. Did your first MAX arrive at the beginning of COVID, or was it in service before COVID?
It was shortly after.
I thought it was a relatively new airplane to you. I guess that, again, was caused by the first grounding, that you should have had them earlier, right?
That's right.
You're kind of used to these airplanes not showing up when they should. So what's the impact that the current uncertainty...
We talk about the delays right now because it's a pressing item for you.
Yeah, I think everyone would like to hear about them. It's a big story, isn't it? So there's so many different aspects to this, but I suppose the first one is the here and now. You're not going to get the airplanes you're expecting, presumably, because no one is. The number of deliveries is going to be a lot lower. I don't think even Boeing knows exactly how many they're going to ship this year. What sort of effect does that have on your fleet planning, your rollover plans, lease situation with the current fleet? It must be quite a dynamic situation you're finding yourself in.
Right. Let me clarify one thing, because I want to make sure that this message is clear. So we have no technical issues with Boeing. Quite the opposite. We're not affected by the MAX 9 door plug. We don't have any door plugs. We don't have any doors at that location, right? And on all the aircraft we have. So technically, not a factor for us. Actually, we're very, very happy with the MAX 8 that we're operating. 69% better fuel efficiency. So we love the aircraft. Really great. What we are affected, though, is the sort of relationship Spirit, Boeing, FAA, obviously, and the, you know, artificial production cap that has now been put on Boeing with 38 737 coming out of the production line per month.
We can't even get near that at the moment.
I know. We just talked about it. 26 to 34 is kind of what some folks are seeing, but we are above the 30 in some months. So the problem on that is that it has this ripple effect. And so for 24, 25, we're doing what every airline does. You know, we're looking at lease extensions. For 24, we're covered. So for those of you interested, 25 is still open. We're still looking at leases for that year. But we're very flexible. We're a small shop, again, 4,000 employees roughly. And our time to react is very quick. On 24, we're covered through lease extensions, through ACME, through wet leases in. Obviously, the rates are now a little higher than they were last year. But don't forget, we have a 40%.
A little higher?
Yeah.
Before the Mercury's in.
More than a little, yes. But the benchmark you have to compare it against, we have 40% tour operator share. So our tickets are sold 12 to 18 months out. And so that capacity is something we absolutely need to deliver. And so our sort of price point on the short-term capacity plugging the leaks is a little higher. Not for the operating leases.
Right, sure. Okay, what about the deployment of the Dubai MAX order, which was last November? So potentially 90 aircraft, and given your previous behavior, it looks like you're expecting they'll all come at some point. Do they all roll through to the middle of the next decade? Is that the delivery schedule?
That's right. So they start rolling in as of 28 until 2035. And I think you said the breakdown already, 45 firm orders, 5 options, 40 purchase rights. The 45 firm orders are 28 and MAX 8s and 17 MAX 10s. We also have an upgauge option on the previous order, the 42 aircraft order to the MAX 10. Obviously, that's also going to be affected by the FAA slowdown. But
you're not going to take the 9 as an interim because you can't get the 10. Although your 10s at the moment are 28, right?
They would officially come in 28 unless we upgauge some of the previous order.
Would you look to take the 9 like some airlines are doing?
Negative. So we looked at, when we looked at the, before we ordered the 90, we looked at Airbus 320, 321 NEOs. We looked at the 737 MAX 8, 9, and 10, and the 9 was not what we want.
And you can't use, could you use the connection you have with your two parent companies and access they have to slots for Airbus aircraft?
That's a funny anecdote, but when we talked to them, is there anybody from Airbus in here? Because when we talked to them, we said we were interested in the A321 NEO because it's an interesting aircraft. The MAX 10 compared to the A321 NEO in terms of earning capacity, 239 seats on Airbus, 230 seats on Boeing. Obviously, you know, 9 packs does make a difference in the summer. But their delivery schedule was 2030 month unspecified. That was the answer we got. And, you know, we're growing at 10 to 12% every year. We've grown at 10 to 12% every year despite, you know, a military coup in 2016, an earthquake last year. I mean, Turkey has been an absolute rebound country with average growth rates in the last 35 years of 10 to 12% every year. So we can't wait for 2030, probably December, for an Airbus 321 to be delivered.
Okay, I'm sure there'll be some questions on the floor on the MAX, so we'll move on for the moment at least. Can you just explain the relationship that you have with your two parent company? We touched upon it then, but they're 50-50 shareholders. What's the function of your business to their strategy, and how is the relationship with them running on a, you know, daily or weekly basis?
Right. So 50-50 joint venture, we're headquartered in Frankfurt, Germany, and Antalya, Turkey. A Turkish airline provides the chairman of the supervisory board, Ahmet Bulut, who's the president and CEO of Turkish Airlines. Lufthansa provides me, basically, as the CEO, so it's sort of reciprocal. And then on the deputy side, board and CEO, it's exactly the opposite. That's sort of the play. I think in terms of the role, you know, SunExpress has been in the market for 35 years now, and it's really more of a financial strategic investment. You know, sort of the relationship with the mainline doesn't really affect us in any way. And in some areas, it's actually really positive. So for example, you know, we do piggyback on some of the synergies our shareholders achieve, for example, on fuel hedging, on insurance products, on maintenance deals. We piggyback on some of that. And on others, you know, it's more important to be small and fast and agile. And I think the latest aircraft order is one of those examples.
And I guess your view is a good credit, given who your shareholders are from the leasing community. So what does the network look like at the moment? You touched upon that again. You've got Turkish base. Everything touches Turkey, as you say.
That's right.
But we haven't talked about the UK, but you do fly to a lot of places in the UK, don't you?
Yeah, and that was driven by that growth. So we've selectively flown to the UK before summer 22, but summer 22 is really sort of the milestone when it all started. We've operated into 5 airports in 22, and then you can sort of add 2 airports every year. So we went to 7 airports last year, 9 airports this year. Started with 400,000 seats, went to roughly a doubling of that, 750,000 seats the year after, and we're shooting for 1.3 million seats this year. So a great, great, great story. And the interesting part is that the UK is not only interesting in terms of sun and beach travel, but also in terms of that diversification of product portfolio. So for example, folks going to, you know, their golfing trip, or, you know, booking the extra leg room, don't forget, buying the golf bag special and stuff like that. That's interesting because it obviously helps us with the yield development right now.
And that's, those new passengers can change the dynamic of the purchasing behavior, right, on board the airplane.
That's absolutely correct, and I'm glad you put a glass of water in front of me for that.
So the
that's what he said.
So it's all great news, except, as you know, it isn't always great news in this industry. You walked straight into it when you came across from Lufthansa. There's so much at the moment we could talk about. There's the supply side, which is obviously a big issue, but there's also the concerns around the local conflicts escalating. There's the political tensions on a broader scale. So what's keeping you up at night? What do you worry about, the unknown unknowns or some of the known unknowns out there that keep you on your toes?
I'll give you a typical CEO answer, and starting with a show-off rather than a problem, but our revenue is 90% in euro and 60% in cost. So we're paying our employees in euro in Turkey, which leads to a very low attrition. So we're pretty independent of exchange rate and inflation, which is really, really good. 85% of our tickets are sold in Europe, so, you know, Turkish inflation and sort of weakening economies is not one of our drivers. However, what keeps me up at night is that, you know, there are obviously price increases that are significantly above, you know, consumer price index inflation rates. And last year, when there was a lot of tailwind through fuel and FX effects, you know, suppliers really jacked up their prices. And if we're lucky, we can pass on, you know, 2 to 3%. It's definitely a low single digit number to our customers. I'm partly, you know, faced with 70-75% cost increases on certain buckets, air traffic control, maintenance programs. So that's really, there's a disconnect here between sort of supplier costs, not only on timing, you pointed that out multiple times, but also on sort of the cost level that we can pass on to our customers. And there's a disconnect where just reality needs to kick in at some point, and where we need to come. The political situation, or you also mentioned sort of the crisis. I'm assuming you meant Ukraine and Gaza and stuff like that. Or?
Those two at the moment, but that's the two big ones now, isn't it?
Is there more to come?
No, that's what I'm saying.
We've been very lucky. We haven't operated into Russia before the war. We are not affected by it operationally, and we've never focused on the Russian tourist segments. But given the growth we have, obviously, and you'll see that with the UK expansion, UK is now the second largest market after Germany, Austria, Switzerland. So we are diversifying, we are expanding. On Gaza, it's also, despite some short flight interruptions, but it's not really affected us.
Brief, we'll have one last quick chat about one other point, then there'll be some questions. So make sure you've got your questions ready. We have a microphone ready. The European airline scene, you call yourself a value carrier, right? So a low-cost leisure airline. How do you see that landscape changing over the next 10 years? I'm talking about perhaps the big guys, the EasyJets, the Ryanairs, the Wizz, and where you fit into that versus the legacy network carriers plying the European routes.
I'll start with the last point. I think the European mainline carriers, and that's not a secret, but obviously you're fighting for ITA, for Air Europa, for TAP. So sort of the picking up the smaller previous national carriers, I think, is well underway, and I think that development is going to continue. I think you mentioned value carrier. Why are we a value carrier, not a low-cost airline? Again, I think the nice dichotomy that we're in is that we're selling our tickets. 85% of our tickets are sold in Germany, Austria, Switzerland. So we have a Western, yield source market for our tickets, while having, a cost side in Turkey, despite paying in euro. And I think that makes us a low-cost carrier on the side of cost. I have no, I don't shy away from competition against, ultra-low-cost carriers at all. We just talked about it over lunch, we put 16 and a half hours of aircraft utilization on our 737s a day. If you look at larger, mainline carriers in Europe, you're talking about 8, 9, 10 hours. So we're highly productive, highly efficient, and on the cost side, can absolutely compete, but we want to also cater to golfing tourists. We want to have the extra leg room. We don't want to, sell out on our in-flight product after 25 minutes. And so that's stuff that, where we want to provide the extra mile.
Okay, two quick fire questions. Quick fire, so very short answers. Then the Q&A. A decade from now, you talked about cost. A decade from now, will Europe have finally resolved its air traffic management issues, or perhaps even be on the way to resolving its air traffic management issues?
I hope.
And we talked about the MAX. There's lots of speculation out there what Airbus and Boeing are going to do to replace this aeroplane and the A320neo. So a decade from now, will an all-new single aisle have been launched by Airbus and or Boeing?
No.
Okay, interesting. That's interesting. You don't even think there'll be one launched?
I was supposed to give you a short answer, Max.
Yeah. I'm always interested in the answer, though. So,
look, I think
you think that by 2033 you won't be able to order anything other than a Max or an A320neo.
No, I mean, look. So now I'm going to give you a long-winded answer.
That's fine.
And I have all the. Look, I mean, if you look at the MRJs, right, the COMACs, and you started looking into sort of the parts that were actually European or U.S. sourced, basically at the end of the day, it was a camouflaged European or American aircraft. Did they take off? Not really. Second, if you look at sort of the engine innovation cycle, now with the geared turbofan, I don't think we're going to see a new, largely innovative engine technology that's really going to upset and disrupt the market in a significant way in the next 10 years. And without that, what's the point in, rolling out another single aisle 737, A320 successor if the engine technology, I think the engine technology is gonna drive sort of the next generation of another year.
As it always has. Thank you. Yeah, but it's interesting the timing of that. Right, questions. We have a microphone, hand up. Oh, great. Mr. Kamalich. Sorry, he's the nearest to the...
You've got a great pedigree, young man. So if you took Jürgen Weber, Wolfgang Mayhofer and Carsten Spohr, which obviously very conservative, Allegro, the Lufthansa business, and you now migrating to Jack the Lad, Middle East, change the world, you know, take the world on. Are you not concerned that, first of all, going forward, following COVID, you know, everybody's gone back traveling, you know, people have got GDP, more disposable income, everybody's gotten an aeroplane. You're coming close to coming up against a brick wall. And you're ordering aeroplanes, if you take the MAX 9, hasn't been certified yet, is not flying yet, per se.
The 10.
And
You said MAX 9, but I think you mean the 10.
Yeah. MAX 10. And if you take the A321, which all your parent companies have ordered to the end of the day, does that not leave you in a bit of a vacuum out there where you're at the mercy of the leasing companies, and the leasing companies are not going to say what a nice guy you are, they're going to rape every dollar out of you, which I'm sure is not too far away right now. So your comments, please.
What, was that a question or a statement?
That's for you to decide.
Look, I agree with a lot of the things you said. let me sort of try to peel the onion a few different ways. I think SunExpress, first of all, has a very unique positioning within the Lufthansa Group and actually also within Turkish Airlines Group. And we're sort of the odd one out, if you like. And that has, and I worked, Max said it before, I worked in network planning, alliances, and fleet, basically at the epicenter of, you know, the folks you mentioned around commercial planning. So I went from the inside of that core to the total outside. And honestly, some of the things I really enjoy is the entrepreneurial freedom I have and being in that bubble. And you know, Carsten was joking the other day. He said, well, if Swiss orders, you know, 10 777, you know, they have to get every single one approved by me, and I'm going to make them sweat for it, right? And Max, you order 90 aircraft, and you go through your board, and I'm being informed that you just ordered 90 aircraft. So, yes, there's... SunExpress has a different role. By the way, I could tell similar stories about THY. But that's exactly what it's all about. I didn't really answer your question before on what's our role for these carriers. I think for Lufthansa, similar to what they're now trying to do in Italy, you know, Turkey is a country of 83 million inhabitants, and it's a huge population. There's 4 million Turks in Germany, 400,000 in the UK, by the way. And so, you know, to participate in that market growth, this market has been growing 10 to 12% every year, I think there is a strategic benefit. For Turkish Airlines, it's a very different rationale, obviously. It's getting, you know, expertise into, you know, and obviously we're selling in Western Europe, so having the point of sale under control, that's a big role of what we do there. I'll leave it at that. I think the other things we can maybe discuss over a glass of wine after lunch.
thank you for the question, and thank you, Max. Richard.
That's going to be a PSS question.
Okay, you know the question. Richard Stokes, actually. Your airline actually chose to go down a different route to Amadeus and Navitaire for their reservation system some years back, a predecessor to yourself. How do you feel about the decision? Has it worked out?
It's worked out. I mean, you know, relationships with IT companies are always love-hate relationships. So if I said everything was, you know, pink and rosy and shiny, that would be a lie. But we're very, very happy with this partnership, and I think the reason is obviously GDSs are too expensive. On the one hand, we're the low-cost carriers, on the other ones, we're the value carrier. But the key thing about IBS that we really, really appreciate is the fact that they were able to integrate basically the seat-only business with the allotment business. And a lot of other airlines in that same market space as we are need two separate softwares, and obviously with, you know, interface issues and two people managing them and so on, integrating that within one software has been a true dream, and so we're very happy with that partnership, and more to come.
Thanks. Next question. Is it all from Table B? Anyone else got any? Oh, come on. Yeah, it's all right, Phil.
We have one over here.
We'll come back to you, Phil. Victoria. Is it about the Trident?
Victoria Moores with Air Transport World. You decided to not continue with the AOC in Germany. I'm wondering whether you see a future for the company having AOCs in any other markets. Thank you.
You know, I'll turn that question around. Why would we? And I think the Air Cairo partnership at the beginning, you know, I put the folks, you know, that you just mentioned on them in terms of safety audits, security audits. So we had a whole team going down to Air Cairo and just checking them out. Brand new aircraft, 2 years old, customer NPS was fantastic, customer satisfaction was good. We're doing all the selling, we're doing all the commercial steering. Why? So I'm just, why? So we have over 80 frequencies a week, Egypt to Germany, for example. We're expanding on the destination profile with them. And we're now doing the same with Bulgaria with Electra, small in fairness, right now only one aircraft. But I'm really wondering why go into like this asset intensive, you know, AOC owning metal and having staff based and all that. I don't think we really need it to tap into markets that are traffic right restricted. And besides, I'm also expecting some kind of liberalization to, you know, become more and more over the next years, also between the EU and Turkey.
So your 160 aircraft will all be for the AOC that you currently have?
That's right.
Okay. Question at the back.
Thank you. Martin Chalker, I'm a retired pilot. I think like you, you may not have retired yet, but the airline industry is slightly odd in that it has a single point of revenue that then services a rather complex and diverse network of companies that all support the one operation. And that produces this oddity in its simplistic form of the airline making very good money when times are good, but then quite quickly moving to loss-making when the yield just drops by a few percentage points. Could you comment on whether that simplicity is actually true and whether there is anything that is done to try and move some of the risk away from the airline? All the risk in the model that I mentioned is carried by the airline. Yeah. And what would you propose, particularly governments might be able to do, to help spread the risk and in particular the motivation to keep costs under control?
Yep. I think that's a great question. I'll start with the last one first. I think what governments need to do is, and I'll give you one example. We looked at air traffic control during the pandemic, and obviously fewer flights. So they said, you know, we have the same fixed cost for infrastructure, so we're just going to distribute the cost of the existing infrastructure, you know, to fewer shoulders. So your prices are going to go up. Obviously, that's impossible, right? So yes, we are stuck in the middle, and I'll sort of hone a little bit or elaborate on your definition of the problem. I was asked the other day, what's the biggest problem of the aviation industry? And I think it's the cycles of revenue and cost don't match. So you buy aircraft or you lease them, you know, or in the past, you know, the school of thought you just mentioned would buy aircraft for 25 years, but your seasonality of demand basically fluctuates not only you know, summer to winter, but sometimes even day by day, okay? So sort of the disconnect between your revenue generation and your volatility in revenue generation just doesn't match at all with your CapEx spend over, you know, over generation, if you like. So now obviously leasing helps a little bit on that, but the shorter the lease term, obviously the higher the rate. So again, we're stuck in the middle. I think what governments need to do, and this ATC example is a good one, they need to have longer horizons. And this is where, you know, the median voter theorem comes in, that politicians typically, you know, don't get elected for 25 years, they get elected for 4, 5, 6 years, so they try to maximize basically their voter count for that short period of time. But if you had a longer time period where you could, you know, amortize and depreciate CapEx, then that would be a fairer share. I'll give you one example. Synthetic aviation fuel facilities are now being rolled out, and obviously some of that is new infrastructure, new capex. If the concession for those companies is only given for 10 years, you know, then the price hike you can expect will basically be a 9-year depreciation over that capex, and that's going to be passed on to you. But the usage time of that infrastructure is probably 40 years, 30 years maybe. And that's where I think the governments really, in general, governments really need to sort of have the usage time frame represent more reality. Whether it's, you know, underutilized ATC towers, whether it's synthetic aviation fuel pipelines, whether it's airport facilities that are, you know, then given to airport operators, stuff like that. I think the time, the disconnect of the time frame here needs to be made more realistic. Does that answer your question, roughly?
Thank you.
So we've got time for two more questions. I think, is it Michael?
Yeah. I'm just asking a question to keep it away from that table over there. Thank you very much for coming to speak. You mentioned you've going up to 9 airports in the UK. I think you said 75-85% of your revenue out of the DAC region into Turkey. I guess my question is, how do you deal with the potential cannibalization? Because as a value airline, I'm assuming that you're giving up, or the greater parent group is giving up, full-service carrier fares for a low-cost carrier fare. So how do you deal with that cannibalization? Thank you.
A great question. I actually don't think there is cannibalization. So if I look at Lufthansa's interest to fly into Turkey, just to take one specific example, they're interested in flying in Istanbul. And mostly they're interested in flying in a Sabiha out of the two airports, right? We don't operate out of Istanbul at all, zero. So what we do is, again, based on those three customer segments I said, we grow along the Riviera, Antalya, Bodrum, Dalaman, Izmir. We grow into Anatolia, Kayseri, Diyarbakir, Gaziantep. Those are the, you know, ethnic folks living in mainland Europe, traveling back to their family. And these are segments that are where it's sort of the medium income level. I think we had a person talk about that. The medium income level is rising. Travel is becoming more affordable. And that's growth we're seeing. Again, Turkey, you know, has been a market that's been growing 10 to 12% CAGR every year, despite massive setbacks. You had SARS, you had a military coup in 2016, you had an earthquake with over 50,000 casualties last year, and, you know, the line goes up. So I think that is not cannibalizing growth or cannibalization growth. This is incremental additional growth that we're seeing because of tapping into new customer segments, new products, and also extending time frames.
And by the way, it sounds like Carsten doesn't need to be asked about the routes you're going to fly anyways. So, Phil.
Don't tell him that, though.
Well, probably two questions in a question.
Wait, is this table B again?
It's the last one, don't worry.
We're allowed.
Okay.
Couple of things. If Airbus gets to 75 a month on the 321, can you get aircraft earlier than 2030? And how do you feel Boeing will react to being a 30-70 market share versus Airbus with the MAX, given that, as correctly, we don't see any new programs coming?
Those are two questions for Boeing and Airbus, really. But I can just tell you sort of my perception from the meetings I have with them. You know, Boeing obviously is very humbled by everything that's happening. We have, for example, we have a technician team on site in Seattle. We're happy from a technical point of view with the aircraft. Where this is going to go, you have to ask the aircraft OEMs. From my point of view, sort of your question on Airbus versus Boeing or Airbus and Boeing, you know, right now, again, we're at 77 aircraft in the summer peak this year. That's the size of an airline where I think a single fleet still makes sense. With the 166 aircraft we're shooting for in 2035, that may change, and then it's important to basically not be, you know, dependent on one single aircraft manufacturer. And I think the dependency actually moves on into the engine space right now, and the engine space is almost more critical than the aircraft manufacturer right now. So over 150 aircraft, I would definitely try to diversify our risk base into, you know, a multi-fleet operation, just to keep it in balance. And by the way, again, going back to you, these smart men you just talked about have gone out of the 737 7-8 years ago, if I remember correctly, 9 years ago, and they're now re-entering the 737 market for exactly that reason. So they just ordered 737s, despite their large A320 fleet, which I think proves that point.
So with that, I'd like to thank Max for his time and hand to Tony for the vote of thanks. Thank you.
So the reference to gold is there's 28 of us going a week on Saturday. Max has asked for the flight number to absolutely guarantee there's plenty of refreshment on board. So Max, absolutely fantastic. That was brilliant. Great insight to quite a few different subjects there. Thank you for your very frank answers on all of that. And thank you for all the questions from the audience. I think that was a great session. Max, number two, thank you very much as well. And on our behalf, you're now an honorary member of the Aviation Club, so please come back and visit any time, and maybe take the RAC Club next time as well. And there's a few little bits and pieces in there from us.
Thank you very much, Tony. Appreciate it.